Welcome to People More Interesting Than Me, the podcast, where I step back and let fascinating individuals take the spotlight. Join me as I sit down with incredible guests who captivate and inspire, showcasing their stories, experiences, and wisdom that make them truly extraordinary. Tune in for engaging conversations that'll leave you enlightened and entertained. I mean, at least I'm entertained. This week, we have the distinct honor of welcoming a true pioneer in the realm of curiosity and exploration, Jamie Grove. Jamie is the visionary co-founder of the renowned Mini Museum. His team meticulously assembles portable collections of dinosaur fossils, lunar rocks, and pieces of history. From ancient relics to celestial wonders, this promises to be an episode filled with insight, inspiration, undoubtedly a few surprises along the way. Enjoy. Well, first off, thanks for being here, Jamie. I appreciate you being on and volunteering your time.
I'm happy to be.
I know you have a busy schedule, and I know we were talking before that, like, we're the kind of people that if we're not, what is it like? Isn't that like the common myth of sharks that they don't sleep? They do sleep, I think it is, but they just like coast. Like, I think they just coast in the water and they sleep. Yeah. Let's start off the episode with what is the Mini Museum for people who don't know what that is?
It's an interesting question because the Mini Museum itself, when we think about the Mini Museum, it is a collection of objects from across all space and time, encapsulated in an acrylic, so that you can hold it in your hand, and you can hold, you know, billions of years of history in the palm of your hand. And it's really kind of overwhelming when you hold one of these objects in your hand. And that's the Mini Museum. That's the idea of the Mini Museum. Of course, the real idea of the Mini Museum is that experience of holding that in your hand and connecting you personally, to everyone else. Not just everyone else who's here on the planet now, but everyone else who's ever been on the planet, and, you know, even non-human species, and putting you in different places, and even places that aren't here, you know, the moon, Mars, and other various bodies in outer space. So it's about kind of expanding your mind and really just kind of giving you a sense of place in the world. Now, that's what the Mini Museum itself actually is. And we've changed over the course of time. We're a 10-year-old company now. We just turned 10, and we've shared over a million objects with people all over the world, over 120 countries. And we don't just make large collections anymore. We sell individual items. Some of them are you know, very fancy, and some of them are very simple. We believe that every collection starts with a single treasure. I mean, this is kind of like marketing speak, right? So, but, you know, in truth, that's we really feel that it's important to be able to hold history in your hand. And, you know, if you have something like, I just happen to have this here, which your listeners won't hear, but I'm holding a Spinosaurus tooth in my hand. And, you know, when you have a dinosaur tooth in your hand, not seeing it, not seeing a picture of it, but literally holding a tooth that, you know, went into another creature at some point in time, probably a fish, and, you know, and fed this giant creature that lived 99 million years ago. It's very powerful. And it's one of those things that will change you when you start to enjoy these things. I guess that's a long drawn out answer.
No, but that was great. And, mm-hmm. and, even though it was well rehearsed, I think you are able to sum it up just because you know it so well. I'm just going to start this preface it with, I am not lying. So the reason I found out about you guys is like about, I wouldn't say it was a year ago, maybe 6 months, 7 months ago, one of my coworkers had mentioned the Mini Museum. So looked it up, saw that you guys were in Fairfax. I was like, weird, because I like, what are the odds of like, and they didn't even know it was in Virginia. To preface mm-hmm. it that way, and that was the crazy part. But I was looking for gifts for my son,
And I tagged it on the bookmarks to get a Spinosaurus tooth because he's 3 years old. He loves dinosaurs. He corrects me when you say Coelophilus and like right. all these other different animals. It's kind of sad. And obviously, you know what happened. I waited to the last minute and there was no Spinosaurus teeth last near Christmas. And obviously. No, but then I was like, this would make an amazing episode. Like it's something that's just like I mean, like anybody listening is like they've always wanted. You go to a museum, you go to I don't know, you look online and you see these things and you never think I'll have a piece of this. I'll never own that. That'll never come close to me. And it's not just like I've looked over the site probably for an hour total and it's like you've got like royal items, you got meteorites, you've got, like I said, dinosaurs, you've got memorabilia from bands, you've got like you guys must have meetings and you're like, let's try to get this. Is that how it's let's put it this way. What is it like for your procurement process after 10 years?
I guess there's no simple answer to that because It comes from all over the place. And I would say that it begins with the curiosity that we have about the world and everything else. I mean, it really does. We're all a bunch of nerds here. And so we have bona fides. Speaking of Fairfax, most of us here are ex-Think Geek, and Think Geek was a Fairfax company. So, you know, we're all nerdy folks and we have lots of different interests. And so when we talk about things we might want to get, we have probably, I would say we have the most interesting Slack of any company in the world because we don't do normal business stuff in there. Well, I mean, there's some, but there's also lots of cool stuff that we share back and forth. So we get each other excited about different ideas and what have you. Sometimes we just drill in on a topic and we are looking for something from a particular age or time. And then we'll just drill in and then we'll say, okay, what's gettable? Gettable is our word. You know, what can you get? And also along that line, you know, what are people not going to be upset about? Because we do take these items and not always, but we do reduce them in size. So you want to look for the right kind of material, something that's ideally already broken up. Something that isn't the only thing that exists of its kind. We wouldn't do something like that. We are sharing these. And like you said, you know, you're looking for a tooth for your child. I don't, and I have children too, and I don't want to, you know, put things out there that people might go, oh, well, like what am I teaching my child when I, you know, give them something like that? We want that to be as ethical and all that good stuff that we can, you know, we want to be proud of what we do. And so that's an important part of the process too. But in terms of how we actually do it, we know people all over the world and very specialized people all over the world. We participate in auctions at every auction house you can imagine. Christie's, Bonham's, you name it, all the fanciest places. We also go and procure things ourselves, obviously with permission and what have you. And it depends on what it is. Like, you know, we went to get the Amazon River a couple years ago, and you don't really need anyone's permission to go to the Amazon River and take some water out. We actually end up getting permission. We actually got involved with some local folks outside of Iquitos in Peru, which is like really down in the Amazon, at least as far as Peru is concerned. So, you know, that kind of thing is part and parcel of what we do, because you're getting the story also of, you know, the real people who are living in these places. So, yeah, it goes all over the place, right? There's so many different things that we do.
So how would you say, I guess, I mean, you guys have been doing this for 10 years. In what ways do you think the museum kind of contributes to education? I know we talked about like you can. You guys are making little bits of this. Obviously, you're not taking, because, for example, you have spacecraft stuff. That's quick question. Has Edvar Hazy ever, have you got anything from them?
We have things that, actually, so it's funny you mentioned that. So we have a piece of the SR-71 that's sitting on the floor in
is that is that the big one in the middle, the one who's done the flight the from West Coast East Coast in 2.5 the X-Men
exactly. Yeah, it was in one of the Transformer movies too, right? It turned into Jetfire, I think.
That's crazy. I think everyone, that's like their, you know. Like,
I mean, that's why it's right there in the middle. Yeah. It's an amazing aircraft. And we have some of the nacelles from the engine in the back. They're called turkey feathers, and they're meant to be replaced. And we met a former technician who had some of these, and he actually, you know, he had them with permission, but he would turn them into rings, and we bought some of them ourselves to, so we could, you know, also then share them with people. But it was funny enough, I contacted one of the curators, a curator of Cold War aircraft at Udvarhazy, not thinking that they would welcome us out there because, you know, there's a, what they do at the Smithsonian is different than what we do. We love them, and they kind of secretly love us, I think, to some degree. But the Cold War aircraft curator at the time, I don't believe she's there anymore, but at the time she was very excited about it. I said, I can just bring one out to you and we can look at it. And she was like, yeah, you can come out. I'll give you a tour. I'm like, well, I might as well ask, can we take a picture with the plane? And she's like, of course. And so like, we brought all our gear out and we walked into Udvarhazy. And for your listeners who haven't been to this, the Air and Space Museum in DC, there's one in the city, which has lots of amazing things, but there's also one out at Dulles Airport.
I would argue that it's, I don't know. I think it's much better. I haven't been to the one in DC in a very long time, but like,
they just redid it. It's really nice, but I would agree with you. I'd much rather go out to Udvarhazy. I'd rather see the Enola Gay and the space shuttle.
They just have more space. Yeah.
Yeah. And they have tons of stuff out there. But yeah, when you go in, there's a, you know, security and all that stuff. And we go in and we're like, yeah, you're going to want to call the curator before we like actually go through your metal detector or do anything. And they're like, why? I'm like, because I have a piece of the airplane and pull it out. I'm like, I have a piece of the airplane that's sitting on the floor out there. And they're like, yeah, you can't come in with that until we get okay. And so it was pretty funny. But and then people, of course, gathered around while we were taking pictures. They wondered who we were. And then we got to go behind the scenes and take a tour and see how they preserve items at the Smithsonian. And that was fascinating because their process is very, very different from what we do. There were a lot of things I saw and I thought, oh, we do that, but we do that different. And, you know, it was really cool to see that. But yeah, that was our Udvarhazy adventure. But yeah, we have stuff from Udvarhazy. I'd love to have a piece of the Enola Gay. I don't think that's ever going to happen, but.
Yeah. No, but that's crazy because, I mean, they process it for obviously longevity and aesthetics outside of acrylic and all this stuff. It's just funny that like these chemical processes, because we talked about like rust with metallic items, but like,
yeah,
it just goes down onto a like a nano level for preserving on either longevity or I guess whatever you guys are trying to do, what the end goal is.
Well, if we're going to encapsulate an acrylic, that's a very, I mean, frankly, it's a very abusive process because the acrylic itself, you know, you've got chemicals involved, but you also have heat and pressure involved. And so when we prepare something for inclusion in acrylic, there's a lot of testing that we do. And there's also stabilization and a lot of stabilization, talking about the Smithsonian and Udvarhazy. They have at the Air and Space Museum, they have Amelia Earhart's little red bus, the plane that she flew across the Atlantic in. They have that. And this is actually in our current, our new edition that we are just releasing now. We have pieces of that. In the 70s, the Smithsonian actually changed out the fabric on it when they were restoring it. And then they sold some of that fabric, believe it or not. It's something they would never do now, but back in the 70s, things were different. They sold some of the fabric to a collector who then cut it up into larger squares and then made displays, which the Smithsonian even sold as official displays. And I collected those displays for many years to get enough fabric that we could, you know, share with everyone. But preparing that fabric for inclusion in acrylic, oh no, nobody's ever done that before. And it's, you know, it's a nitrocellulose lacquer paint that they use like on electric guitars. So it looks super cool. And back in the 30s when they painted it, it was probably absolutely brilliant. But that stuff is very heat sensitive. It's unbelievably chemical sensitive. It will crack in a heartbeat. So, you know, it's almost 100 years old. And so it's on fabric that's also 100 years old. How do you cut that? And so there's a lot of experimentation to just cut it, and let alone how do you embed it? How do you preserve it? How do you make sure it doesn't, you know, completely dribble away? It's going to have some problems with heat. You can't avoid that, but you know, that was a very challenging object to work with. Yeah.
So speaking onto that, you guys have been doing this for 10 years, mm-hmm. and this just popped into my head. And when you said you took a little sample of it, has there been any cases where you've ruined something? Obviously, you take a little piece of it first and you try it, but have you had any instances where it's just like we messed up?
Yeah. So, you are pretty careful when you're doing this, because depending on what it is that you're working with, you might be working with a meteorite, say, that, you know, costs $2,000 a gram. You know, some of the rarest meteorites are very, very expensive. So you've got to be ultra careful. Yeah, but there's definitely times where you go, oh, I can't believe I just did that. Where an example would be, we were working on the Hindenburg, another air and space object. We were cutting up.
That's ironic, huh? Hindenburg.
Yeah, yeah. And then somebody cut it too small, and they cut it way too small. Like it was not usable. So a fair amount of material and time was wasted on doing something that, you know, we save everything. So, I mean, just about everything. So I still have those little tiny bits, and that was 8 years ago, that project. And maybe we'll include them in jewelry or something, although I'm not really sure people want to wear the Hindenburg, but you never know. But yeah, so you have that object sitting around that you've done that to, and you're like, yeah, that's a nice memory.
That's a good lesson. But it's an expensive lesson. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that doing this for a long time, it's like, well, the question is, how do you start on an object? Like, how do you, well, you just cut it, or you just break it, or you just do whatever it is you need to do to it. Well, but how do you do that? You just do it. You just go for it. You can sit there and look at it all day, but that doesn't get you where you need to be.
Yeah. Cause if I was obviously you do this all the time, but if I was in that position, I'd be like, there's no way I'm touching that.
Yeah.
Like maybe if we take a little bit off of it and we start, and I would imagine you look at it or like, okay, we can break this down to this amount. It gets a good view. We can sustain it in acrylic pretty well. And A, B, C, you know better than anyone would. How do you, you're dealing with all these different contacts all over the world, stuff like that. How do you verify,
authenticity?
Authenticity, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So provenance is the fancy word for that. But
oh, I have never heard that before.
Provenance is all the backstory of, you know, whose hands did it pass through? What are all the details?
Chain of custody, basically, in a layman's term, right?
Yeah, totally like that. That is different almost for every single object. Some people have asked us, you know, is there third party validation of this? And we don't. You can get a piece of paper, you can pay money, and somebody will say, yes, they have a process, and we trust the process. And that's literally what you're paying for with a third party validation. We self-certify, and we spend a lot of time researching objects before we include them. That process could be consulting with other experts. We have general knowledge in a ton of fields, and we are also the expert in certain fields. But when it gets out of our realm of like the stuff we really know, we'll go talk to other people. And, you know, that is, you know, drawing on that network of people that we know all over the world. So if we had, you know, a particular, oh, let me think of something that might work. Let's say a stone tool And we've come into this now. Stone tools I only buy from certain kinds of people because, you know, they can be faked and there's all kinds of other things. And so the people that I usually buy from are already the experts. But, you know, those are people that I would go to and say, all right, what do you think this is? You know, can you, you know, let's talk about the actual process by which this object was made. And, you know, where did it come from? And, you know, sometimes they may even have a sister object to that, which came from the same quarry or what have you. That's not unusual. So they could, you know, you're able to verify that. Then there's other things with radiocarbon dating. In some cases, we have mammoth meat that we know how old it is because we had it radiocarbon dated. And so we know exactly that it's 19,741 years old, or is it 991 years old? I have it written down.
You're completely fine. I would imagine
it's definitely 19,000 years old.
You must, like, the other prerequisite I would imagine to work there is you must have a good memory. Like,
yeah, we have some people here that don't have great memories. I have a good memory, but we have people who, I mean, the prerequisite here is to be curious, right? That's you know, if you're curious about stuff, that's important. The other prerequisite is you have to be able to sit and do the same thing over and over and over again. A single mini museum has 250,000 specimens in it. So, because the full run, right? So you have 30 objects or 29 objects across all those different ones. So you have to be able to sit and do this work, and not everybody can do that. There are people who can literally not sit still in a chair, and we've had people in and they want to get out of here after the first day, even though we're all pretty chill. It's just that work, it's just too much for them.
So my dad is like the type of guy who'll buy presents and hide them around the house, and then by the time it's Christmas won't remember where he put them. Have you had any instances where, like, I can't even, because I was looking at the website today, even to refresh in my mind, and you have, and you touched upon this earlier, you have larger items as well that you guys sell. And I saw something really cool, half of an ankylosaurus tail. That's crazy that you have.
Awesome. Tail club is amazing. It is really an awesome piece. And I had to have it when I saw it. The person that I got it from, he was, of course, the person that dug it out on one of his private leases. And I went to see him, and I saw the object, and I was like, oh yeah, like, wow. And then he told me all about it. It was just a fabulous piece. It just looks so good.
That is awesome. That's just such a, like, a
I mean, it'd be hard for your dad to hide that in the house and not find it again. Well, it's pretty big.
Well, to preface that, is there any instances where you've just lost something, like, as to this day you don't know where it is because it was, like, not cataloged or something like that?
Yeah. Big objects, probably not. We have a really good system for cataloging things, and I have some people who do that work that are extremely detail-oriented. It is their jam. They like putting labels on stuff, and they like writing stuff in spreadsheets. And so truly losing an object is, I can't really think of something that just disappeared and we never had it. That's not to say we haven't had, like, finished specimens go missing for some reason, where somebody had a container of objects they'd worked on, and then it was just gone and they couldn't find it, and you just wondered where it went, for like, what happened, how could it go anywhere, where is it, up in the ceiling in our workshop, did it go in the floor? You do lose little items on the floor on occasion. We have a little game called Food or Fossil here, where, you know, you find something, you're like, is it food or fossil? By the way, if it hits the floor, it's gone. We never go down and use
it. Oh, yeah. You don't know if it's a coelophilus or a pterodactyl. Yeah.
Right. Well, you also don't know if it picked up a bunch of lint or whatever.
Oh, that's true, too.
Once you put that in acrylic, it's not great. But yeah, it's... Yeah, I don't know that we've lost anything, like truly lost anything, because we're very careful.
No, that's great. And How, like, obviously with COVID, I mean, people have changed, and like, obviously Zoom has revolutionized like teleworking, stuff like that. Sure. But that must have, like, I don't know, I would say jetpacked your acquisition too, right?
Because the pandemic was so hard. I have one couple that, you know, married couple, they ran the office here, our shop, and then we would get drops. We have a little airlock area, and they would put drops for us to work on, and people would come by and take that home, and then they'd do their work and bring it back in. And it was nuts. And of course our customers were just amazing. You know, we had the community really supported us through all that. Couldn't have done that without them. But yeah, there are a lot of things that have changed in the last 4 years. You know, there was an exciting time where, you know, like crypto was hot and people had just tons of money and everybody wanted a Spinosaurus tooth. And, you know, there were a lot of really wild things. Privacy has changed a lot of things. Some of the things with iOS 14.5 have changed online advertising. And so that's another thing that's kind of changed the game. TikTok, of course, coming out of nowhere, that's changed things too. I mean, there's still lots of people that love science and history though, so that never ends, and so that part's fun. But you know, we try to change a little bit with the times. There are some things we don't do. I mentioned TikTok. We played around with that in the early days, but it's not a platform that I feel real comfortable with. But yeah, it's been pretty wild. It's been a wild time.
And on site, do you guys have like an electron microscope for any like verification of stuff or anything like that?
I have a number of microscopes, but that kind of microscope is something that I would send out of house. So if I were going to do mass spectrometry on something, you know, I really wanted to get down into it. Scientific grinding, we've ground T-Rex bone up to below 100 microns for inclusion in inks. That's that kind of stuff. You know, I do that stuff out of house, so I'll find a specialist that does that work. That's again tapping into the network of other people who, like, this is what we do. And sometimes there's also an advantage to that. A lot of those folks are academics. They can file papers or write papers. We've had meteorites where we get a meteorite. Meteorites are really interesting because they're found in the desert, and for the most part, a lot of them are found in Northwest Africa. But the other, you know, mostly that's because it's easy to find them, easier to locate them than, you know, a different area. But when you have a meteorite, you want to have it analyzed. And so how do you do that? Well, you cut a slice of it off and you send it to an expert who can actually do all that work and will file all the details about that object for you. You don't try to self-certify that on your own.
No, that makes sense. How many cases are they like, oh, I want to keep this for my own studies, or can I break off a little piece for myself? Is that the case?
Yeah, I've not sent like a whole object, and nobody usually does. You usually are in control of how much you're going to cut off and send in. The same thing goes for radiocarbon dating. You know, that you don't really need to send in a ton of material for that, depending on what it is. Then they can do what they need to do, and you're not going to get it back. That's for sure. You know, we'll get that sample back.
So of their 10 years, what is the most exciting thing that you've procured?
The most exciting thing that we've procured, I think it depends on what your poison is. Like, what do you?
Oh, okay. My poison. Let's say, I don't know. Let's go with the birth of the world. Not like human. Not really involved with humans or dinosaurs.
You mean life, or are you talking about the actual formation of the planet?
Formation of the planet. We'll go with that.
Okay, yeah. So formation of the planet. So we have zircons that are the earliest Earth. They're over 4 billion years old. They're really, really like early Earth stuff. Those zircons are little crystals that are embedded in a host rock that comes from Australia called the Jack Hills Formation. The Jack Hills Formation is only about 300 million years old. only. I mean, our world, that's fairly young. But the zircons that are embedded in that host rock are 4.1 billion years old, which go all the way back to the beginning. So if we're talking about Earth, we literally call this earliest Earth. Those are super exciting to get a hold of. There are also other formations around the planet that you can get that are pretty neat. One that we have is it's in our latest collection. It's the magma ocean, and it comes from Greenland, and it's basically when the planet was in the Hadean period that it was basically this giant ball of magma. And so that's what this particular formation comes from. We call it the magma ocean because it's kind of a fun name. I think when you get something like that, that's super exciting because some of those objects are not easy to get, right? You have to go somewhere that's usually hard to go. And we have another volcanic specimen you may have heard of this, the Great Dying, which is the largest extinction event. It's before the dinosaurs rose in their time. It's 300 million years ago. Well, no, it's not. It's 232 million years ago. But the Great Dying was a huge pyroclastic flow that occurred in Russia, in Siberia. It's called the Siberian Traps. It was, you know, kilometers deep. It lasted for a million years and it killed everything mostly because of gases, not necessarily the magma killing anything, but getting a piece of that, super hard, like, because, you know, you think, okay, well, it's everywhere, right? Well, it's not all exposed, and there's only a few places where it's exposed, and those places are in very remote parts of Russia. And so you have to talk to people who can go and get it for you. And so that part's exciting too, because you get to talk to a lot of colorful characters. And that part's pretty fun. We talked about the pandemic earlier. This is one now I won't be able to probably ever get it, but we were on track to get some apples from Chernobyl. And I mean, that's one of those specimens that I'll never have it. I was going to go get it personally. I had someone who was going to, there are tours, of course, and there are other ways to go there with permits and whatnot. So you can go, and there are apples that are there and they're growing there. And that would have been pretty amazing to get that. But at this point, with the war and everything going on there, that one won't ever happen, I don't think.
That's crazy. There's apples growing.
Yeah. There's apples growing, and there's all kinds of wildlife that lives in the exclusion zone there. Same thing in Fukushima. They have all kinds of other things that are happening there. Although their radioactivity in that
three-eyed fish.
Three-eyed fish, right? It's like Springfield, right?
Yeah. What is your favorite item that you've collected?
You know, that one is, it's like, it's very difficult to choose what is your favorite item. Usually my favorite item, and I have several, but they're also connected with the specimen preparation process and what I enjoyed. And I would say that of all the things that we have a very considerable number of things. The things I like the best are probably some of the meteorites from different bodies out there. And I think about working on those and the quiet time of working on those and the thoughts that you have where you're spending hours, days, weeks, very focused with a microscope, working on very tiny things from another planet. And you're doing it. And it's like, wow, this is amazing. The moon is very precious to me because I've worked with that material. And when I read about astronauts, you know, the Apollo astronauts who went to the moon, they talk about a thing called moon cough, because the fine regolith there, the material there is very fine, and it gets everywhere, and you breathe it and it smells a little bit like gunpowder. I've cut so much lunar meteorites that, you know, I actually developed moon cough.
I was going to say, do they call that white lung?
Yeah, it's not great. You don't want it. And but yeah, that one, I think that those things are really precious to me. The human stuff is interesting, but you know, I don't think too much about that, just because it's so fleeting. Like, we have not been around very long in the grand history of the world. And so, you know, I think the jury's still out on humanity, even though, you know, we kind of dominate the planet at the moment.
No, you make it. So where do you see the mini museum going a little bit down the line, 10 years? Like, what's a big acquisition that you hope to have by then, or any expansion plans, anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, we have six editions now, right? So, and every single one of them is different. We have grand collections, which, you know, contain lots of buried items. And then we have our Age of Dinosaurs collection, which is all focused on dinosaurs. And we have lots of mini museums on the roadmap. So we have Mini Museum 6 on the roadmap. We have, we've already announced Mini Museum Oceans, which will be an ocean themed museum. And there are several other collections that we have going on. So, you know, when I think about where is it going, I mean, I think we're just going to keep sharing the universe with people. I mean, because it kind of goes on forever, right? And so, you know, if you're curious and you really think about these things and you're excited about it, you don't have to stop. Now, that said, there are a lot of changes in our world happening right now. And, you know, a friend of mine, he's a fellow with the Royal Geographic Society. His name's Wolfgang Gropke. We actually have his book. He has several books, but we have his children's book about Mary Anning on our site. He had this really interesting observation. Museums are struggling right now. Right. And I mean, really struggling. And we're not talking about the Smithsonian, although they have for a long time, but we're talking about small museums, very, very small single museums. And they're having a hard time. Why is that? His thought was that there was a boom in interest in science and history that began during the Victorian era, and that boom is starting to tail off. And so, do I think that we're entering a time where people are maybe a little bit less interested about where they come from versus maybe where they're going? There's a lot of more interest in going to space, but not necessarily looking at what we did to get there. I think that there's just a lot of really big changes happening in the world about what people are interested in. That it makes me a little. I mean, regardless of any like business stuff, I mean, because what we do is not, I mean, this is not like a huge business. It's a lifestyle thing. What bothers me about that is that if you don't know where you came from, if you're not curious about all that stuff, what will you trample on when you go forward into space or what have you? You know, how can you find compassion if you don't have any context for that compassion? You don't. And the reality is that without that history, you just don't have that level of compassion. You become apathetic, and that becomes kind of a sad place. So I worry a little bit about that too. But then again, I'll do something like, get a little depressed about that. And then some kid, you know, will ask me a question, I'll go to a school or just some neighbor kid, you know, who's like, oh, I hear you have dinosaurs. I'm like, yeah. And then we get in this kind of cool conversation. And maybe I'll like say, hey, hold on a second. I'll go get a bone and we'll talk about it. And, you know, and then I'll give it to them. I'm like, here's a little piece of bone for you. And the look on their face is just like, what? Like, this is amazing. So, you know, I get all crazy about it, but I think still putting history in people's hands the way we do, we have to find new ways to do that, because that's really what our mission is, because that's the thing that makes you connected. Yeah.
And I definitely agree with that. I think, like you mentioned before, TikTok, I think all these platforms where immediate attention and immediate gratification makes it so it's a lot hard to push other forms of media towards, especially children.
Gets sure.
A lot of stuff that was easy to do, like dinosaurs and everything else. Like, for example, my son, I mean, he loves every form of dinosaur, like books, videos, but like he listens on Spotify to a dino rap, and one of the lyrics, which is really good and catchy, and I would never hear it in my age, it was something like, I'm not going to butcher the lyric, but it was talking about the Toronto Raptors, but it was worked into the song so eloquently. And I was like, wow, that's really this is a kid's song and it's mentioning a NBA like basketball team. I'm like, they're really like putting in the effort here.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then I was like, I told my wife, this is a tangent on a tangent, but I had read this story that the Washington Wizards were almost named the Washington Raptors. Because when, I don't know what, whatever team came from the Wizards, it was Jurassic Park era.
Okay.
And Raptors was one of the names that it could have been. And I just thought that was fascinating. And
that is fascinating.
And then I guess Toronto Raptors happened maybe a little bit after the Wizards. But yeah. Yeah, it's I guess the learning and history of society just has to update to everything else that's going with it to influence the young. And I don't know,
I mean, I'm so excited about young people in general. So yeah, my kids are older now, but I did a lot of work in school when my kids were in school, and I did a lot of photography. I did photography for band. I did photography for theater for like 10 years, basically. And I mean, I took 50,000 pictures during that period of time. And, you know, I did it for the kids, right? Because they're awesome and they should look their best. And so that was what I was there to do. But seeing young people and seeing how excited they are about just life in general, that can kind of like shake the jadedness off of anybody.
Yeah,
so no. You know, as you get older, you kind of go, oh, everything's terrible and it's all a big mess and, you know, whatever. But I trust the kids, so, you know, maybe where my vision is isn't important. It's just I have a lot of skill, and hopefully somebody younger will tell me what my vision should be, and then I'll make it happen.
No, that's great. And that's a great way to lead to my next, or the final question. What is something that your parents did that you'd like to pass on to your kids, or maybe your future grandkids at some point? And what is something that you would do differently or knew that your parents wouldn't have done?
Yeah. So I grew up in the 70s, right? And that was a really weird time to grow up because life was changing quite a bit then. And my parents were a police officer and a nurse, and so they worked split shifts and all that sort of thing. And they were young too, right? So the idea of people being parents when they're 20 years old in today's world is like, wow, how do you make that happen? That's really rough. And they did it by just pure hard work. And so, and they didn't always like it either. And as I got older, I mean, you know, I look back on the things that I guess that's the thing I would take away from, you know, the experience of my parents, is that they were young and they didn't always know what they were doing. They didn't always know whether it was right or wrong. But they trusted each other, and they trusted just working hard. And, you know, so that's something that I don't think I appreciated that when I was young for a lot of reasons. And it wasn't until I was about 30, actually, my mom passed away, and she had an accident. And then I had children, and I was like, oh, yeah, I didn't know what I was doing. And I went back and said, okay, what's the right way to do this? And, you know, hard work. And, you know, passing that on to my children is something that's super important to me. What I would do different about that, what I have done different about that, is my wife and I have poured everything into our kids, and we haven't held anything back. We are there for our children all the time. And that was something that, you know, my parents couldn't do because they were young and they didn't have stuff. And, you know, as they were getting older, it was just a different time. But for us, it's a little different. So we have always put our kids first in every possible way. And of course, now our kids are old and don't need us anymore. And they never call. No, I'm just totally kidding. My kids call me all the time. I talk to them every day. But that's I think the big thing that's different is that we are here for our children. We exist for our children. And we had them for a reason. And, you know, that was something that we wanted. So it wasn't just we had love to give to children. We wanted that. We wanted to live that life, to be parents. And that is such an important thing. You know, I'm sure you looked at my background. I used to work for Highlights for Children, the nation's largest children's magazine's beloved thing. And their mission is, you know, children are the world's most important people, right? That's their big phrase. And of course, when I worked there, I believed it, and I still do, and they still do. And you know, that kind of sits with you, and you know, I still believe that.
Yeah, that's crazy. Yeah, and Highlights, I mean, like everyone probably mentions doctor's offices, don't
yeah
they? When you say that, and that one little page like 16 at the bottom, find the same hidden pictures usually that are that's great.
Yeah, it was super fun. And yeah, I loved working there. It was pretty great. And you know, I've always done something after having children. That's also another thing. After having children, I made all career choices that my kids would be interested in, you know, at different times. So I was at Highlights for Children. And then later, after, you know, after my time ended there, which was really my choice, I ended up going to work for Think Geek, and my kids were a little bit older, and Think Geek was super cool to them, you know, Star Wars and Star Trek, Minecraft and all that stuff. And, you know, it was just, it was awesome. And then later, getting into science and history, that was something that was super cool too. And, you know, kind of exploring that. My oldest actually works here and has worked here for the whole time. So he's worked here since he was in high school. And now he's in charge of our marketing, and we write books together. So, you know, I was the ghostwriter for all the books for Mini Museum. And now he's actually writing, and he's not a ghostwriter. He's literally the author of the books. So that's been fun too.
That's awesome. That, you must be very, that's like one of those things that you don't really, it's not that you don't appreciate it, but like every once in a while you look back or you have like moments that you're like, this is amazing. Like it's awesome that like he's having fun and I get to spend time with him. You know what I mean? Like some people don't really have that chance, but that's awesome.
Yeah. That's a incredibly positive thing for me. And my youngest worked here this summer. He's a mechanical engineering student. And so he got to do some material science this summer by cold rolling steel and cutting a nuclear weapon up. And
wow.
Yeah.
Is he at Tech or UVA?
He's actually out of state. He's at the University of Cincinnati. And,
oh, okay.
And they've got a pretty great mechanical engineering program. And in fact, right now he's at Honda. So just ooh, as a side note, Cincinnati has got one of the oldest co-op programs in the country. And after your freshman year, you go into a rotation where every other semester, you're not on campus. You're working. You're like, you're there.
Thanks again for this. I really appreciate it. And sure, I hope.
Thank you.
If you like this week's episode of People More Interesting Than Me, please follow me on Apple Podcasts so you won't miss out on more episodes like these.